Well, ski season is just about here. Believe it or not, some people are actually looking forward to hitting the slopes. What are the hottest things on the slopes this year? Helmet cams. They allow skiers to share their experiences via online videos. Think about it. strap a video camera onto your ski helmet. Out at Steamboat in Colorado, a spokesperson says that the mini cams are almost the norm now. And Lauren Kasten says they're incorporating the content into its social media and marketing efforts. Of course they are. Kasten adds that the helmet cams take bragging rights to the next level. There are already plenty of thrill seekers on the slopes. Do they need another reason to go all X Games on us? Well, they have it whether we like it or not. Welcome back to Current State. We're 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We talk about the Affordable Care Act and the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and how that may impact you coming up in just a little bit with the head of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation, the CHRT, based in Ann Arbor. Also, filmmaker Christine Vachon of Boys Don't Cry and other acclaimed movies joins us later on this hour on Current State. At the top of our program today, many community stakeholders are interested in building communities that are both socially cohesive and diverse. However, a new report suggests these goals may not be attainable. Using a computer-based model, MSU sociologist Zachary Neal determined that segregated neighborhoods are more socially cohesive than diverse ones. And Zachary Neal joins us now to break down this paradox. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Your report analyzes the relationship between diversity and socially cohesive communities. Let's break this down. When you're discussing a socially cohesive neighborhood, what do you mean? What does that neighborhood look like?
Right. Well, what we have in mind by a socially cohesive neighborhood is the sort of neighborhood where each individual, each resident, has the sense that everyone knows who they are, that residents look out for one another, where we see patterns of social networks and relationships that are dense or what we might describe as tightly knit.
Mm-hmm. And when you say diversity, a lot of people will think immediately of racial diversity. Is that what you mean as well in this case, or is there more to that?
Well, we're certainly interested in racial diversity in this study, but we're really interested in all kinds of diversity. So we're also interested in ethnic diversity, in diversity by income or social class, diversity by education. So we're really interested in all different kinds of diversity. Certainly racial diversity is one that comes to people's minds, but it wasn't necessarily our sole focus.
Okay. So cohesiveness is predicated on the establishment of these networks, as you put it. What factors influence how people build these networks?
Well, that was really the piece that we were trying to build on in this study. And we focus on two forces that generally guide how people form relationships. The first is the tendency for birds of a feather to flock together, or what we call homophily. It's a general tendency for people to have more opportunities to run into others that are similar to themselves, and so more likely to form relationships with those sorts of people. The second force that we look at is the effect of proximity, of nearness. And people, likewise, have more opportunities to run into others that live near them or work near them or go to school near them. And so relationships tend to be geographically clustered. And what we see in these models is that when these two forces work together, homophily and proximity, we get this finding that we observe, that more segregated neighborhoods tend to be more cohesive, and more diverse, integrated neighborhoods tend to be less cohesive.
Hmm. So the less socially cohesive it becomes, the more diverse it is, a neighborhood is, the less socially cohesive it becomes. Well, the more segregated a neighborhood is, the more cohesive it is. How did you arrive at that conclusion exactly?
Well, certainly we've seen this sort of finding in many different empirical studies. So this finding that there's a relationship between segregation and cohesion is not the new piece of this story. The new piece of the story is what's causing this relationship. Now, we weren't able to conduct an empirical study of real-world neighborhoods. That would be problematic because, for example, we can't ask a person to live in a diverse neighborhood and ask another person to live in a segregated neighborhood and tell them, well, we'll come back in 6 months and see how things are going.
So you worked with a network or a computer model.
Exactly. So we built this computer model that allowed us to create simulated neighborhoods, and we could create very segregated simulated neighborhoods. We could also create very diverse simulated neighborhoods, and we could create neighborhoods that were at any level in between. And so we'd create these simulated neighborhoods and then allow people in these neighborhoods to form relationships by these principles of homophily and proximity. And it allowed us to look at the sorts of social networks, the sorts of social patterns and cohesion that might emerge in these sorts of neighborhoods.
Now, your report appears to suggest that segregation can actually pay dividends, that it can be a good thing. And saying that in 2013 just sounds wrong. Does this report suggest that we should reconsider the way we understand communities and segregation specifically?
Well, I think the take-home message from our conclusion is, as we hear from lots of different studies, certainly from our doctors, from others, that too much of something is often not good for us. And so what we find is too much cohesion might be bad for us, and too much diversity might be bad for us. That what we're looking for is not so much a completely diverse, completely integrated world, but also not a completely cohesive world, but some sort of balance. If we lived in a completely diverse, integrated world, our social lives would feel fragmented. They would be hard to navigate. We would not run into the same people time after time.
Yeah.
Likewise, if we lived in a completely cohesive world, we'd find ourselves walled off from other points of view. We'd fall into the trap of groupthink and emerge with very narrow perspectives. And so what we're really suggesting in this study is not to try and maximize diversity or to maximize cohesion, but to change the focus of the conversation to finding an appropriate balance of the two.
Very interesting. I think some number of people listening might hear about your study's conclusion and say, well, that's not the case where I live. Or they might look at New York City or Chicago and say, hey, they're racially diverse and they're cohesive. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that's a really interesting counterexample. We might think of, say, New York City, Manhattan, or Chicago as places that are very diverse, very integrated, but also have a strong sense of community, a strong sense of civic pride.
Right.
The thing we have to remember about these places is that at the city level, they appear very diverse. But on the ground level, on the street level, they're actually really quite segregated. These are places that often get described as cities of neighborhoods. They have Chinatowns and Koreatowns and gay enclaves and these different pockets segregated pockets of diversity. And so what we see in these places is a patchwork of segregated neighborhoods that by being stitched together in this patchwork makes segregation work, makes segregation possible in a way that isn't problematic and in a way that still builds cohesion.
So you're suggesting that segregation can pay dividends on a relatively small scale.
Exactly. Bringing like-minded people together provides a sense of comfort, a sense of order. But having these segregated patches near other patches also brings an element of diversity into the picture. So it's really an issue of finding a balance.
We're talking with MSU sociologist Zachary Neal about his most recent study in which he studied the relationship between cohesive neighborhoods and diversity in those neighborhoods. You know, what immediately comes to mind is the Scandinavian countries are often cited as obviously bigger than a neighborhood. We're talking entire countries here that are remarkably, I guess you would say they are remarkably segregated. There's a uniformity to the values and the ethnicity in those societies. They tend to be fairly progressive at the same time. That's one example of a larger geographical unit where you see this kind of thing in play. It's almost like a neighborhood writ large.
Sure.
Is that relevant here to what you're studying?
Well, I think it could be. It's important to remember, say, for example, when we're thinking about these Scandinavian countries, they're relatively not diverse on racial grounds,
exactly.
Maybe on ethnic grounds or religious grounds, but they do have diversity in other forms. They have diversity in terms of occupation, for example, in terms of interests, in terms of the sorts of music people listen to, the sorts of films people watch. And these are important kinds of diversity also. And so I think that's one of the reasons in this study we didn't want to focus on any particular kind of diversity or any particular kind of segregation. What we wanted to bring to light is that mixing in these ways can occur on many different dimensions, and focusing on just one may leave out part of the picture.
Does it make you want to study this on the ground, though? I mean, you went to a computer model here for this thing. During the course of your study here on this, were you really tempted at times to say, I want to study this on the ground. I want to study this on the south side of Chicago. I want to study this in New York City.
Very much so. I think that's one of the next directions for this line of work. Inevitably, these computer models are unrealistically simple. They can't capture the full complexity of our actual social lives. And for example, in this model, we don't know what effect, say, the creation of a public park might have in one of these hypothetical neighborhoods that could bring people together in an otherwise segregated place, or a public school or a community center. And so we need to look at real-world neighborhoods where these actual things exist to see how that might shape and refine the sorts of conclusions we reach in these simplified models.
Society seems to spend a lot of time working on policies and plans to try to build social cohesion and diversity, at least in the neighborhood level, I would say. How is it these features have become so important to civilization, to society?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, and I think the reasons these social goals have become important depends on the national context. Certainly in the United States, we have a sense of segregation as being very problematic, and we attach racial ideas to segregation when we think about it. And that's led us to pursue diversity as a very strong social goal. On the cohesion side, I think what drives us to pursue that as a social goal, as a social policy, is this nostalgic sense of neighborhoods the way they used to be, where everyone knew your name, where you could borrow a cup of sugar from your neighbor. Now, it may not have ever actually been that way, but we have this sense of nostalgia about strong, dense, tightly knit, cohesive communities being somehow better and being something that we should try and recover. And so we found ourselves in this position where we, on the one hand, very strongly want to pursue cohesion, and on the other hand, very strongly want to pursue diversity. Mm. And what this study does is ask us to take a step back and rethink what we mean by those two things. Why are we looking for them? And do we really want to maximize both, or do we actually want a little of one and a little of the other?
Who do you want to make aware of what you've found here? Policymakers, community leaders. Who would you like to read your report?
I'd certainly like community leaders, policymakers to understand our finding and understand why some of these policies that are focused on pursuing diversity and some of the policies focused on pursuing cohesion may not be working as well as we want them to. This suggests that they may be conflicting, fighting against one another. And this may provide us a path to finding cohesion where we hadn't expected, or a way of pursuing diversity in ways that we haven't tried before. But I'd also like everyone to understand that what this study does is suggest thinking more carefully about what we mean by diversity and thinking more carefully about what we mean by cohesion, why we think cohesion is good or why we think diversity is good, and asking whether the sort of world that we really want to live is in a world that's a little bit cohesive but not completely cohesive, and a little bit diverse but not completely diverse to the point where every person you run into is completely different from the last person. And so it asks people to rethink their conventional notions of segregation and integration, rethink their notions of cohesion and fragmentation.
Well, does your study suggest then that we may be closer to some kind of ideal today than we may think?
Well, I'd be cautious to suggest that there's an ideal. We conclude by suggesting that what we need to find is the appropriate balance between cohesion and diversity. But I don't know that there's one balance that everyone would be happy with or that would be suitable for every community. There are some cases where it may make sense for the residents, for the population, to be slightly more segregated to get the benefits of cohesion. And there may be other cases where the benefits accrue from slightly more diversity and maybe a little bit less cohesion. So the ideal point may be a moving target. It may depend on the culture. It may depend on the people that are living there.
Intriguing discussion. Zachary Neal is an assistant professor at Michigan State University with a joint appointment in the Sociology Department and the Global Urban Studies Program. We've been talking about his latest research. Zachary, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Amid the chaotic rollout of the Affordable Care Act, an Ann Arbor organization is doing its best to explain what's going on and what healthcare customers can do about it. The Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation, or CHRT, is a nonprofit partnership between the University of Michigan and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. On its website, its stated goal is to, quote, promote evidence-based care delivery, improve population health, and expand access to care, unquote. To help us understand some of the challenges associated with Obamacare and to explain its role in this transformation, we welcome the director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation, Marianne Udall Phillips. Welcome to Current State.
Well, thanks so much, Mark.
Tell us more about CHRT's primary work here. What do you do and who do you serve?
Well, really, our goal is to help policymakers make decisions based on facts. And so, you know, our sense is that we serve the public at large. We try to provide information explaining things like the Affordable Care Act, understanding data on how healthcare is changing in our state, what the cost of healthcare is, et cetera. We run demonstration projects to help demonstrate what works to improve quality and access to care. And we have a fellowship where we bring policymakers and researchers together to see if we can speak the same language and if research can really help policymakers.
Was CHRT around before the Affordable Care Act, or was it formed because of the Affordable Care Act?
No, we were formed before. We were formed in 2007, and with this general goal of improving evidence-based care, population health, and access to care. So we've been working with researchers on ways to do that before the act was even debated in Congress, but clearly with all of the changes from the Affordable Care Act, it's really raised the need to help people understand what's happening and how this law affects how we all get health care.
Are you an awful lot busier than you anticipated you would be in 2007? It sounds like it.
Yes. Yes, we're very busy, and we've been spending the past several months doing lots and lots of talks to consumer groups and with legislators and physicians and hospitals and just about everybody you can think of to understand healthcare.
Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is one of the key players here in your organization. What role do they play exactly here? What's your connection to them?
So Blue Cross and the University of Michigan are two big funders. They formed the organization. They're partners in what we're doing. And what happened in 2006 is the University of Michigan sold their health maintenance organization, MCARE, to Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And as part of that transaction, both entities really wanted to support more of the research that had been coming out of MCARE and the university to help the public better understand healthcare and improve the quality of healthcare. So they decided to form this organization. We're a nonprofit, a 501c3. We're hosted by the University of Michigan.
Let's address a few of the big unanticipated challenges that have unfolded recently relating to the Affordable Care Act. How have so many, I guess it's at least 150,000 Michigan health insurance policyholders, how is it they have lost their policies after very memorably being told by the president that they'll be able to keep them?
Yes, well, that was a most unfortunate statement that he made, and I think he was probably at that point thinking more generally about the employer market, where most people are able to keep their policies and really aren't so affected by these changes. But it is the individual market where all of this turmoil and all of this change is occurring, and you're right, it is about 150,000 people in our state that received cancellation notices of their health plans. Now, it's not that they won't have health coverage. They're getting, being offered new health plans, some of which are going to be lower cost than the plans they have today, some of which will be higher cost. They have a lot of choices. Many people will get financial support, tax credits, to afford those health plans, but they are different from what they've had. And they're different in part because the Affordable Care Act requires a very broad set of services to be covered. There are 10 categories of services, and really very few health plans have covered that full range of services before. So the health plans canceled their policies in the individual market so that they could create new policies that were aligned with what the Affordable Care Act requires.
Can you generalize, Mary Ann, about the I don't know, I hesitate to use the word quality, but can you generalize about the kind of policies that have been getting canceled? Were they generally, apparently they didn't offer the benefits that the Affordable Care Act calls for. Can you generalize and say that these were substandard policies?
You know, it's really a mixed bag. There were some that were good policies, but they didn't cover exactly what the Affordable Care Act requires. There are some that were really limited benefits and really weren't giving people much coverage at all, and those are what people sometimes call substandard policies. I actually think in other states, a lot of what got canceled were really, really poor policies. In Michigan, I think we've generally had somewhat better coverage, but I would still say that you know, most people in Michigan would agree that the individual market has been broken, and this is really trying to make it better, although it's confusing for a lot of people, and some people it won't make it better for, but many people it will. We did a survey at our center last year of consumers in Michigan, and only 44% of those who buy their coverage individually said they were happy with their plans, and that's before the Affordable Care Act went into effect. So we know that this is a segment of the market that has been very unhappy, has had difficulty finding coverage that's affordable for them. Many of them have had very high deductibles and not great benefits. And so the hope and the idea is that these will be somewhat better, significantly better in some cases and somewhat better in other cases, plans. And for many people, they'll get financial support to help them purchase that coverage, so it could be at lower cost.
We're talking with Mary Ann Udall-Phillips, the director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation, or CHRT, based in Ann Arbor. You mentioned the rise in deductibles. A lot of policyholders have been confronted by that here in Michigan. Occasionally, they have really shot up dramatically. And the deductible, of course, is the amount of money that policyholders agree to pay out of pocket before their policy covers the cost. These have been rising for years, as I understand, but why have they jumped so dramatically now?
Absolutely true. Employers really have been trying to find ways to lower the cost of health care to them, and they've tried many things in the 90s. They tried managed care plans and health plans, tried wellness programs and case management programs, all sorts of things, and employers found that those things did not substantially improve their trends, their health care costs. And what did was to raise deductibles and copays, and it did it in a couple of ways. It, first of all, clearly it transfers some of the cost of the health plan to consumers and to employees. But also, we know from the research that copays and deductibles do discourage utilization. So people with higher copays and deductibles use fewer services. The problem with that is that even though we have some data to say for most people that hasn't affected their health negatively, It has affected the health of some people. And the problem with just across-the-board copays and deductibles is that it's kind of like a meat axe approach. You know, you're just doing even valuable services get high copays and deductibles, and people reduce the use of those services at the same rate that they reduce the use of services that maybe don't really make a significant difference. So we'd like to see people use what's called value-based insurance design, where they vary the copays and deductibles based upon the type of services. But most employers are just raising deductibles and copays across the board.
Mm. The government healthcare website, healthcare.gov, launched on October 1st. Lots of people couldn't access it. What's it like today, especially for people here in Michigan?
Well, you know, it's getting better. I was with some folks the other day who had been able to get on it, and a few who had been able to get through the whole process as it was originally envisioned. The federal government says that by the end of this month, 80% of people should be able to make it work very well for them. But it's not perfect. It's still going down, and there are certainly groups of people who are having difficulty going on it. So a lot of what's happening now is the health plans are saying, we'll help you, we'll enroll you through us. And actually, the health plan websites are excellent. So you can go on the healthcare.gov website and compare health plans. They have a button to do that. That works perfectly. You can see in your area what the different health plans are and what the costs are. And then if you like a few of them, you can go then to the health plan websites, and they can tell you what kind of a tax credit you would get for that plan based on your particular circumstances, and they will be able to enroll you directly through those health plans. So,
and new products are available here as well, new features to these policies.
Yes, there are. There are, you know, in Michigan, in most communities, you'll have a choice of about 40 different products. There's really quite a few health insurers. 13 health insurers in Michigan are offering products on the health insurance exchange. And there is quite a range of products, everything from a new co-op type plan to all sorts of provider network plans. So one thing that's really important for consumers, though, is to see what the providers are in the plan you're interested in, because some of what's being offered on the exchange are limited networks of providers. Some are very broad networks of providers. So you need to make sure the provider you want to go see is in the plan you want to sign up for.
I know you try to deal with this monster as objectively as you can, Mary Ann, but I want to ask you if you're willing to speculate regarding the political climate here and what the future lay, where the future lay with regard to Obamacare. Is the president's signature legislation facing some kind of existential crisis here?
Well, the political climate certainly nationally is very, very bad in this regard. And, you know, I think there's a headline article in the New York Times this morning that speaks to the fact that the Republican strategy is to capitalize on all of the problems with the law and keep focusing on those problems for political reasons. I wish the focus was really on fixing the problems. There are problems. There's no question. It's a very complicated piece of legislation. There are several areas that it would be better if there could be some legislative fixes, but the climate is not good for that at all at the federal level, and I just think that's really unfortunate. I think we're actually pretty lucky in Michigan, because I do think at our state level, certainly the governor wants to do what he can to make it work. And so I think we're a little better off in Michigan than in some states, mm-hmm. But certainly the federal level, it's very tough.
Mary Ann Udall Phillips is director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation based in Ann Arbor. Thanks, Mary Ann.
You're welcome. Great to talk with you, Mark.
Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Filmmaker Christine Vachon is behind some of today's most successful independent movies, including Boys Don't Cry, Far From Heaven, and One Hour Photo. The MSU Film Collective is screening her movie I'm Not There tonight, and Vachon will speak about the state of independent film on campus tomorrow. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Christine Vachon about her career and independent film in today's Hollywood.
Well, I mean, it's a time right now of really interesting change, because The way, you know, the way people are consuming media is changing drastically, meaning that people are not just, well, people are still going to movie theaters, but there's so many other kinds of platforms to watch stories. You know, whether it's, you know, Netflix or Hulu or YouTube. And it means that there's a lot more people can make stories. And I think it's just, you know, it's kind of a fascinating time.
Well, the technology, it seems, is also possibly making the art of making a film less expensive, too, which gives entree to a wider circle of people who might have an interest in making a movie.
That's right. It's a lot more accessible. And, you know, and I think that means that people have a much, you know, much more of a do-it-yourself mentality and feel like it's within their means.
The differences between the world of independent film and the studio machine, what are the biggest differences? One thinks of money, I suppose, but creative control, I would also imagine, is an issue when it comes to choosing the path of independent film.
Yeah, but I think it's more complicated than that, because what started to happen is the studios, I mean, as you can see, if you just, you know, look and see what's playing in your local theaters, the studios are becoming more and more risk-averse, so they tend to make franchise films. And those sort of smaller budget dramas that used to be very awards-driven, they are the ones that are kind of suffering, and we're having to make them for a lot less. So I feel like it's kind of a difference now. It's not just about creative control. It's really more about what are the kinds of movies that are actually being made.
Have you had opportunities in the studio business of making a bigger budget movie than you're used to, maybe? I would assume you weren't asked to make Thor.
I was not asked to make Thor, none of the Spider-Mans or Batmans. You know, we've made movies. It starts to get a little muddy, because we've made movies that have been bought by studios. We've made movies with, you know, with the Weinstein Co., with Fox Searchlight, with Warner Independent. So I think it's a question of really blurred lines. Like, at what point does a studio movie become a studio movie, and what point does an independent film become a studio movie?
That leads me to ask you about Killer Films, which you formed with your partner Pamela Koffler in 1995. I was going to ask you about the creative control aspect of owning your own company or running your own company. Are there other reasons for forming your own company like this?
Well, I mean, I kind of don't know any other way. I mean, our company Killer has you know, over the past 25 years, has become a real brand. And that's, you know, that's really important to me, that when people see Killer in front of a film, they think to themselves, okay, I'm about to see something interesting, provocative, and highly original.
A great name for a company, by the way, Killer Films.
Yeah, not so good for children's movies.
I won't ask you to pick a favorite from among your films, but I do want to ask you about which, in your opinion, and you can name more than one if you'd like, have had the greatest impact, either commercially or on the film-going audience. Talk about the impact of some of your movies.
Well, of course, I have to use that as an opportunity to plug my latest film, which is in theaters right now, Kill Your Darlings, with Daniel Radcliffe and Dane DeHaan.
Are you a writer?
Because I've got a job for a writer.
Rhyme, meter, conceit. Without this balance, a poem becomes slack.
Then how do you explain Whitman? Well, he hated rhyme and meter.
What's your name?
Allen Ginsberg.
So in some ways, for me, you know, the most impactful movie is the one that's, you know, that I'm trying to get people to see right now. But, you know, a lot of the movies we've made have had a lot of resonance. And I just was in Poland for a retrospective, and we showed two movies that I'm particularly fond of. One is called Velvet Goldmine by Todd Haynes, and the other one is called Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and it was directed by John Cameron Mitchell. And I was stunned at how many people showed up for both those screenings and how many young people showed up. I mean, people who were, like, you know, barely in kindergarten when those movies came out. So that was kind of amazing to see that those films still have such a life of their own.
I would have to bring up Boys Don't Cry, if only because of the Oscar-winning performance
by
Hilary Swank. And certainly a cultural impact and not just a box office impact.
Lana, what are you doing here?
What are you doing here?
The girls' house?
Oh, place is crazy. It's like, put you wherever they want. I mean, it's fine with me.
Brandon, what's going on?
You want the truth, don't you? I'm a Rampidite.
What?
Come here. It's a person who has both girl and boy parts. Brandon's real name's Tina Brandon.
Boys Don't Cry was a big, you know, it was a watershed moment in so many ways because, you know, I think nobody really believed a movie about that subject matter that was that serious and that in-depth and that tragic could go, you know, could get under the skin of such a wide audience. And obviously, you know, it's hard to imagine now, but when Hillary was cast in the film, she was genuinely an unknown. I mean, you know, couldn't get arrested unknown. I think she had a couple episodes of 90210 under her belt, and that was it. So it was an amazing story all around, extraordinary filmmaking and an extraordinary performance from somebody who seemed to come out of nowhere.
You brought up your new movie with Daniel Radcliffe. That makes me wonder about the extent to which you hear about actors who say how badly they want to work in independent films. Some actors will work in big budget films so they can afford to work for less money in independent films. Is that giving filmmakers like you entree to the bigger names out there in Hollywood?
Well, I mean, in some ways it's always been that way because, you know, actors for the most part tend to gravitate to, you know, great scripts and great material. So, you know, an agent said to me not so long ago that film is the new theater. You have to do it for love instead of money. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But yes, I think, you know, there's a lot of actors like Daniel who, you know, obviously don't need, you know, to be part of another franchise. So they're looking for things that really test them and stretch them as actors.
I want to ask you about television, too, because I know you were involved in the production of the TV version of Ira Glass's public radio show, This American Life.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved with that? Is television also an outlet for independent filmmakers to a greater extent than it used to be?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, going back to what I said before, that, you know, film is becoming more risk-averse, I think television is becoming less risk-averse all the time. And people, you know, audiences turn to TV to see, you know, stories about morally ambiguous characters and, you know, quote, unsatisfying endings or ambiguous endings. And it's a lot of independent filmmakers who a few years ago would have thought that working in television was a come down of sorts are now flocking there because they get to really tell their stories honestly.
Are you interested at all in moving into episodic storytelling? And I'm getting at things like the Netflix programs like Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. Amazon is producing some new original content. Is episodic storytelling something that interests you?
Absolutely. And we've been, you know, we have a lot of things in development. You know, we're really, I mean, the closest we've come is Mildred Pierce. But that was, you know, essentially a six-hour movie. And we're interested, you know, in doing, you know, something like that that lasts years.
When you visit a college campus like Michigan State, are you encouraged by what you see among young people who are interested in filmmaking? And what sort of message do you have for people who want to go into movie making?
I think that in some ways it's time to stop saying filmmaking or movie making, and it's time to start using the term storytelling, you know, or content making, because the real message right now is that we have to be length agnostic, we have to be platform agnostic, we have to take advantage of all the different opportunities, but the notion that you can only say what you want to say in a theatrical length feature film has to go out the window. So I guess my real message to young filmmakers, but most of them seem to know it already because this is how they're growing up, is that they have to be entrepreneurial and they have to really look at all the different ways they can tell stories and figure out the best platform for each story they want to tell.
I would imagine that college-age audiences are already in tune with your message to a greater extent than say, my generation might be.
I think that's correct. But I still think there's some, you know, film schools tend to sort of promote this mythology that, you know, that what you really are trying to do is do exactly those theatrical feature-length films. And I think that in this day and age, we've really got to stop thinking that way.
All right. Well, based on what you just said, instead of identifying you as filmmaker Christine Vachon, I'll thank content producer Christine Vachon. Nice talking with you.
Nice talking to you. Take care.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
As we head into the second week of firearms deer season in Michigan, Current State's Melissa Benmark has been thinking about two groups of people, hunters and high-end chefs, that might not seem to have a lot in common, but do share a common respect for the animals they use for food. She spoke with one of Michigan's noted chefs about nose-to-tail eating and what this new old trend has in common with Michigan's long-lasting hunting tradition.
My name is Chef Brian Paulson. I own the Forest Grill in Birmingham, Michigan. I'm also a full-time culinary instructor at Schoolcraft College, where I specialize in charcuterie, which is the art of preserving food before the refrigerator. I also written two books on the subject, both bestsellers. One is called Charcuterie, and the other one's called Salumi, which is charcuterie is the French version, and salumi is the Italian version. Father of five, married 31 years to the same woman, which is unusual for chefs.
For those of us who don't know the term, tell us a little bit about what the nose-to-tail movement is.
Well, it's about respecting the animal. For years and years and years, everybody wanted to use the middle meats because they're tender, right? You know, the strip loin, the steaks, prime rib on beef animals, or the loin and belly on the pig and so on. And it's just respecting all parts of the animal. And a talented cook, for instance, looking at a pig, right, to cut a nice chop out of the center and cook it perfectly, it takes a certain amount of skill. But take the trotter, or take the tail, take the nose, take the ears, and turn them into beautiful, fantastically delicious food is far more talent than just grilling something off. So the second part of that is that as chefs, I think we're responsible to ensure that the quality of ingredients that we get is fantastic, because one of the secrets of great cooking starts with the ingredients. So if we start with factory-raised, hormone-injected, steroid-infested food, we're doing a disservice to our customers. So we have to create, as chefs, create a demand for small family farms to raise wholesome animals and that they can make a living at. And it's a difficult process, but it's happening, because this whole movement, chefs are now buying whole half animals and butchering themselves, and you pay for the entire animal, so you have to utilize it, because utilization equals profitability in the restaurant business. And it's a respect. We should really know where our food comes from and how to treat all parts of the animal. Thank God we're higher on the food chain.
I understand that some people are even embracing their own butchering with an eye toward, like you said, humanely raised animals, sustainable animals. Witness pig stock in Traverse City recently. What kind of turnout did you have for that? What kind of people?
Oh, it was fantastic. This is the fifth year I've done it, and I do it in conjunction with a master butcher from Vienna, Austria. His name is Christoph Wiesner. And we show the chefs that meat doesn't have to come from a box, or it shouldn't come from a little styrofoam tray wrapped in plastic. And we actually knock down pigs, dehair them, eviscerate them, and cook all parts of the animal, the heart, lungs, spleen, the bladder, the intestines for sausage, the blood. And then, of course, I butcher with Christoph four different animals. And pig stock is centered around the breed of Mangalista, which was almost extinct 15 years ago.
Aren't those hairy pigs?
Yeah, the furry, the woolly pigs are called. They look like big sheep, and they're so kind and gentle. They're just wonderful animals. So I cut a Mangalista, a Berkshire, a Duroc, and then a factory pig, factory farm, grocery store style pig. And we laid all four carcasses side by side. And, you know, 100% of the chefs could identify one animal, which was the factory pig, which was a lean, sickly-looking, pale, pigmented meat. It just looked terrible. And you work your way up by different heritage breeds, and I point out to them that not every chef can buy a whole animal. They might not have the space in their kitchen. They might have the skill set. They might not have the room in the walk-in, but they can buy USDA cuts, and I showed them where the European cuts are as part of it. And I also showed them the difference in the breeds, the intramuscular fat, which is commonly referred to as marbling, and fat is flavor. Fat is our friend, and we love fat, okay? So it's important that they understand that the ingredients that they start with is directly related to the success of the plates that they serve their customers. And also, they have a great responsibility, like I said, to buy wholesome food so there are family farms that can survive, because a factory pig costs 95 cents a pound and the Mangalista costs $5 a pound, hanging weight. So you can see this, five times the price, but it takes three times as long to raise a wholesome animal than it does a factory pig. So this is the revolution that's going on. And the nose-to-tail cooking is directly related to the fact that if you're buying a whole carcass, you're paying the same price for the nose as you are for the prime rib. You see?
Right,
so
right.
You better utilize it, because you can't waste, out of respect to chefs, we don't waste food, but food equals money.
Right.
You can't waste it.
Do you see people that are not chefs, people who are just cooking for themselves, kind of embracing this idea of trying to actually know where their meat comes from and even maybe experience, you know, that it isn't the easiest thing to kill a living animal? I mean, do you see home chefs kind of starting to embrace this movement?
I do, and it's a revolution. It's fantastic. I do cooking classes in my restaurant Saturday mornings, you know, periodically. And during one class, I said, what would you guys like to see me do next class? And they said, I want to see you cut a pig. So it was amazing. I sold a class, 25 just serious home cooks. They wanted to know where the meat came from. I had the farmer who dropped off the pig talk about how the pig was raised. She even told the name of the pig, which a couple people got squeamish about.
Yeah, but, sure, yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, that's going a little bit too far. But, you know, people do want to know where their food comes from.
Well, I guess part of the reason I wanted to do this interview with you, especially right now as we're in the firearms deer season here in Michigan, is that you've got kind of these two groups of people that you can sort of imagine might be a little suspicious of each other. You've got sort of the, you know, Chicago and Detroit foodie people who are interested in these hogs that are, you know, of a heritage breed, and, you know, how, where they come from and how the butchering is done. And then you have all these guys who have hunted deer all their life going out and you know, essentially knowing where their food comes from. And I wondered, you know, I just got thinking, I wonder if there is, or if there is starting to be, any crossover or any more understanding between those two groups of people.
I think there is. And the reason I think that is because I get emails all the time. And people are hunter. I never meet these people. They email me and they'll say, I'm a deer hunter. Can I make a prosciutto out of venison? And, you know, I give them a recipe. You can do that. I tell them what to look for, you know, food safety, of course, all those things. But yes, I mean, it can be done. I get more and more people that are hunters that really care about the animal, whereas maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago, it was the thrill of the kill, and that's all they did. And they got the big horns mounted on the wall, and they sent their meat to the processor, and it all got ground into hamburger. And
right.
That's sacrilegious. Now, I mean, Chef Milos, my mentor from the Golden Mushroom, master chef, he's an avid hunter, and he produced a series of videos on how to age the deer, how to handle the meat, how to butcher it properly, what cuts are best for what type of cooking. It's very important. I've got a neighbor who's a big hunter, and the last 3 years in a row, I butchered his deer for him at his house, and I cut it and showed him, these are roasts. He goes, he would take the back straps out, and then everything else would be ground. And that's ridiculous. So now he's making roasts. He even did a neck roast. He sends me a picture of it. I mean, he's cooking, whereas the previous generation of hunter probably didn't even think about it. But, you know, sure, he doesn't read the New York Times, but, you know, he's aware of the food revolution that's going on in this country.
Do you think Michigan is a particularly fertile place for it? Because even those of us who grew up in the city, you know, in my case, I married a guy who is a lifelong hunter, and we all know someone who hunts. So do you think that this is somewhat fertile ground for there to be some cross-fertilization of ideas?
I do. I think hunters in their soul really are thinking about food because men are foragers, right? And the part of the men need to provide, right? So every hunter doesn't want to waste the food, and they just don't know what to do with it. That's the thing. I mean, there's plenty of hunters that I know, that customers of mine, that go out to Iowa and they partridge hunt, and they come back with a dozen birds, and they're frozen, and they put them in their freezer, and their wives won't touch them.
What do you believe the next step or the next kind of trend will be in terms of people thinking about their food supply and where it comes from and how they treat it?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. I think that starts with chefs, serious chefs and cooks. You see more and more breed-specific items and where the food comes from, you know, like even fish and seafood, you know, Georges Bank sea scallops or Upland Farms zucchini. You know, you'll see this terminology on menus, which is very important, which intrigues the consumer. The next thing I see is farmers markets. I mean, it's just amazing to me. You know, I ride a motorcycle, and I always take back roads, and you go to these little towns all over the country, and there's always a farmers market. And it's interesting is that I've been to Europe extensively, and every small town in Europe, like Wednesdays and Saturdays are the market days. And all the farmers from around the small village will bring their stuff into town and they sell it. We're seeing that more and more and more in America. I mean, you got these small farmers that are raising chickens or zucchini or tomatoes or corn or whatever. And I think people really find it as a food experience to visit the market to see where their food comes from and then take it home and actually cook it. Because there's an attachment to it. When you buy it at the grocery store, you buy shucked corn already at the grocery store, for instance, and it's wrapped in the plastic, and you bring it home and put it in the refrigerator. Already the sugars are turning to starch. You don't know when it was picked. You know, you go to the farmer's market, the corn is there in the husk. You take it home and cook it and eat it that day. I mean, it only takes like 24 hours for the sugars to start to turn to starch. But that corn is so sweet. People remember those things.
Well, Chef Brian Paulson, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we speak with an MSU student who ran a marathon a day for 6 days through mountains in Peru. Our first question, why? We also remember John F. Kennedy's assassination 50 years from that date, and we all remember where we were when we learned of the tragedy. All coming up Friday. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in mid-Michigan and around the world. Alumni.msu.edu.